This is Joe Lockard with the Anti-Slavery Literature Project reading Reflections on Captain Swinton's Journal of a Voyage with Coolie Immigrants. One of the thorniest problems I face in reading the literatures of slavery lies in understanding the relationship between a narrator's description of a scene, imaginative reconstructions by readers, and the effects a narrative achieves. From this complex causality emerges the political voice of any narrative. In anti-slavery literature, such complexity preoccupies me as I work through a continuing stream of text, trying to comprehend both the historical voice and contemporary theorizations. Usually the untangling that I manage comes only through years' worth of work and cumulative appreciation. And yet, what I look for and hope for are those revealing textual moments, points that penetrate through an ever-cloudy consciousness and cause me to understand with a pang of revelation. Possibly this is a fault, for I know better intellectually. Understandings that arrive instantly bear great risk of representing fleeting, miscalculated, or ephemeral comprehension. The conceit of reader understanding is an especial presumption under circumstances of enslavement, with its deprivation of liberty, forced labor, and psychological and physical threats. I felt this limitation particularly when recently I read Captain Swinton's Journal of a Voyage with Coolie Immigrants from Calcutta to Trinidad, published in London in 1856. The use of the term coolie here does not refer to Chinese laborers, as was common use in the United States, but is rather a generic term for Asian laborers, in this case, Indians. The narrative relates the transport of Indian workers from their homes to Trinidad, a migration organized by a British colonial system that sought to replace now emancipated African labor in the Caribbean with a new source of labor. When black Trinidadians refused to endure conditions in the sugar fields, the empire imported more compliant replacements from India, China, and elsewhere as bonded laborers. The conditions these replacement workers suffered, however, were far closer to slavery than free labor. Reading through Journal of a Voyage, as a fairly experienced reader of literatures of slavery, I kept noting the narrative parallels and commonalities between the situations of indentured laborers and stories of African enslavement. A leading commonality was the extraordinary difficulty and high death rates of transport from the Indian subcontinent to the Caribbean. Trinidad-born historian Ron Ramdin refers to this as, quote, the other middle passage, end quote, and some historians have adopted the phrase. The story of the Salcette, a chartered ship that Swanton captained, exceeded by far the average mortality rates of 18th and 19th century transatlantic mortality rates for African slaves. The Salcette embarked on March 17, 1858 from Calcutta, faced no especially bad weather or mortality due to an epidemic, and arrived in Port-au-Prince on July 2 of the same year. Of the 324 indentured Indian laborers who embarked, 120 died en route, a rate of one per day. As Marcus Rediker has pointed out, however, while a key issue, exclusive focus on horrific mortality rates represents a limited approach. He writes that death was only one feature of social terror and an element of a broad human drama. Quote, how many people died can be answered through abstract, indeed bloodless, statistics, end quote, Rediker writes. But, quote, how a few resisted terror and how the many experienced terror and how in turn they resisted it cannot, end quote. These are the sorts of questions that I attempt to understand as a reader at this remove of over a century and a half. The narrative is bare and horrifying. Jane Swinton, who accompanied her husband, copied it out from his diaries after his death the same year. Most of the 16-page tract, published by the Quaker social activist James Carlyle, consists of a daily log of deaths. On the second day of the voyage, March 18th, for example, Captain Swinton records, quote, "An old woman died of cholera. She was rejected on coming on board, but 18 men would not come without her," end quote. This is the first death of the journey. In the two lines of print relating this death lies an entire array of questions. How did she contract cholera in Calcutta, since clearly she was ill upon coming aboard? If 18 men refused to depart without her, she appears to have been a matriarchal figure within her extended family. Perhaps these male indentured laborers brought their own family members with them. How did this first death prefigure to them their collective family future? Elsewhere in the narrative, entire families come to an end. Quote, "Boy, 15, died. This completes the family of father and two sons, rejected at depot for spleen enlargement," end quote. If they were rejected as unfit to travel, why were they permitted to board? Families come undone in the face of mass death. Quote, 23rd, a child 3 years old, died from neglect by the mother, end quote. Whatever human social cohesion they brought aboard steadily erodes and disappears. Repeatedly we encounter the last surviving members of families, as on June 8th, where the captain writes, quote, "Another man died. This is the last of another family who said this morning he was much better and really appeared far from a dying man," end quote. Not only individuals die, families find their final solidarity in death. It is the namelessness that continues to appall as the list of deaths continues, day after day. Quotes, "A little girl. A little orphan girl. Two women. One infant. Another man. One twin child. A nice little girl, 5 years old, died. Three coolies died. One woman. One man," end quotes. It is a list of anonymity of those whose names will never be known or are almost certainly unrecoverable in history. That reduction of humanity to anonymity strikes me as one of the necessary steps towards destroying public compassion. Captain and Jane Swinton, who in the wake of this tract's publication inexplicably continued to enjoy public respect, are almost the only named characters, excepting two physicians and a government official briefly mentioned when the Salsette reaches Port-au-Prince. Not coincidentally, these name possessors are the only whites mentioned in the narrative, although the ship's crew were most likely white. There is a racial dispossession from identity that happens here thoughtlessly and without effort. That reduction into a bald list identified by age and sex links this reform tract to the manifests of slave ships with similar construction. They are cargo, denied either biographies or an opportunity for autobiography. In this scene of daily deaths, names become superfluities. It is precisely this disposal of identities and individual and family histories that enables the scene in the first place. These were the marginal and desperate members of mid-19th century Indian society, those who were, for one reason or another, dispossessed and had no hope beyond selling themselves into bonded labor. As a reader, I am asking these barely noted lives to perform a service from their sea grave stretching over two oceans and thousands of miles. I imagine them rising to the ocean's surface in the form of revivified stories, telling the stories of their lives. My academic work takes me over historical terrains where terror and death pervaded, where stories disappear because lives were demeaned and dismissed by a colonial hierarchy of racial, gender, and class power. Autobiography interests me deeply because of the genre's close, intimate, triangulating relationships between individuality, community, and social power. But how can we read Swinton's narrative as an autobiography of invisible and unknown subjects, especially where these subjects never speak? It is a difficult challenge. We might read the Journal of a Voyage as self-exculpation, particularly where Mrs. Swinton concludes the tract with pages of recommendations for improving, quote, coolie ships, and a belated statement that, quote, had my husband been spared to land in England, it was his intention to lay it all before the government, end quote. Yet the identity stripping of this narrative betrays such claims and identifies the underlying cultural superiority and malevolence, despite Jane Swinton's professed concern in presenting her now-deceased husband's diary before readers. When working with materials such as Journal of a Voyage, texts that frame a horrific scene but provide only limited clues, I find critical writing is the coldest sort of posthumous justice. My heart is with the impoverished, uprooted, exiled, and anonymous dead. This is Joe Lockhart with the Anti-Slavery Literature Project. Thank you for listening.